Masters of Deceit, A Short History of the Jews. Nature, in her infinite wisdom, has put the highest premium on survival of the species. In her profuse variety, nature has brought forth creatures of all kinds, fish and fowl, animal and vegetable, insect and bacteria. Some creatures, like the cardinal and bluebird, are beautiful to behold. Others, like the scorpion fish and the lizard, are not. Some creatures are flesh-eating. Others are herbivorous. Some animals, like cows, forage on the grass of the meadows. Others, like the coyote, the wolf, and the tiger, are predatory. Other creatures, like cockroaches, mosquitoes, and maggots, are parasitic. Each creature has its means of existence and survival, and its means of perpetuating its species. In all, the will to live and perpetuate its own kind is intensely strong. If it were not, the species would soon have died out. In the human species, there is one race that stands out above all others in its intensity and fierceness in its will to survive. That is the Jewish race. How this one race has survived and stayed intact through all the convulsions and upheavals of history for 5,000 years is something remarkable to behold. Whereas some of the ancient races of recorded history, such as the Babylonians, the Romans, the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, as a race, have all gone down the sinkhole of history, the Jew has survived. Not only has he survived, but he has become the slave master of all the other races of the world, although he only numbers a small percentage of the world's population. Whereas the glorious white race has been a builder, explorer, and creator of civilizations, of governments and nations, the Jew has been none of these. On the contrary, he has been the very antithesis of the noble white man. Throughout his history, which goes back more than 5,000 years, during which he has remained united as a race, the Jew has been the parasite and predator on the backs of those nations who have been his unwilling hosts. The Jew has never been a creator, nor a builder, nor a producer, like the members of the white race. On the contrary, he has been a destroyer of civilizations, a plunderer of nations, and a killer who invented the very idea of genocide in the earliest stages of his own history. All we have to do is read the Old Testament to find that in page after page after page, they slew, killed, and plundered one tribe after another. One nation after another was put to the sword, man, woman, and child. Yes, indeed, the Jews are a bloodthirsty race. They have survived over a long period of time, although they have been scattered throughout the other nations of the world. They have been a plague on the body of mankind from the earliest dawn of recorded history. Nor has that plague abated in modern times. In fact, today it is more deadly than ever, and since we, the white race, are the chief target and the chief victims marked for destruction, it behooves us to take a closer look and study our destroyer. It is a fascinating and horror-filled history. It is an ugly story. But study it we must, and understand it we must, if we are to extricate ourselves from our plight and fulfill the obligation that nature has placed upon us, namely the survival of our very own species, the noblest creation on the face of the earth, the white race. The history of mankind is filled with wars and conflict. But of all the conflicts that have ensued between the different nations and the different races, there is only one race that has aroused the most violent antagonisms no matter where they settled. That race is the Jewish race. Throughout all the turmoil of history and all the wars, conflicts and massacres, sooner or later the two conflicting parties settled down and either reconciled their differences and lived peacefully together, or they went elsewhere to live. Not so with the Jews, however. The Jew has never been reconciled with the host nation upon whose back he feeds. Nor have the Jews peacefully migrated to other countries. The history of the Jews demonstrates two things. First, that there has never been a reconciliation between them and their hosts. And second, that no nation has ever succeeded in barring them permanently. Furthermore, as the Jews bored into their host nations and became more and more reprehensible and intolerable, the host nation generally has turned on them and tried to expel them from their national body. However, in no case has a victimized nation been successful in expelling them permanently. In fact, it is surprising that in every case where the Jews were expelled from a nation, often under conditions of humiliation and suffering, within a few years the Jews have returned. Not only have they usually returned, but they then set about with increased viciousness to destroy the host nation upon whom they have previously fed like a parasite. The Jews have since time immemorial been culture destroyers and civilization destroyers. The Jewish problem has been on the back of all nations for at least the past 5,000 years. Whereas the white race, with its creativity and restless energy, has moved to various areas of the world and created civilizations, the Jew invariably followed, bored into their very vitals, and sooner or later destroyed those civilizations. They helped to destroy the Egyptian civilization, the Greek civilization, and were the prime cause in the destruction of the great Roman civilization. When Europe slowly again picked up the threads of civilization from Rome, the Jew was already there and has lain like a cancer upon the body of Europe from the time of the Romans. However, the main center of power of the Jewish worldwide conspiracy now resides in the New World. In fact, in New York, it is the largest center of Jewish population in the world, and New York is the central financial powerhouse, not only of the United States, but also the rest of the world. Since the United States is now also the last great stronghold of the white race, it is the untiring and current goal of the Jew to not only destroy the United States as a country, but to destroy white America, mongrelize it, and pump the black blood of Africa into the veins of white America. Why is it that the Jewish race has survived through all the upheavals of over 5,000 years of history, whereas more powerful races like the Romans have perished? Is it because the Jew is tough? We find that the Jew is tough, but other races, such as the Romans, have been even tougher, and they have not survived. Is it because he is a good fighter? No, he is, in fact, a physical coward, and in open combat he is certainly one of the lesser and more cowardly warriors. Is it because he is more treacherous and deceitful? Perhaps, since this characteristic, he undoubtedly excels all other peoples, but this is not the sole reason why he has survived either. The reason for his survival lies in his unique religion. Early in their history, the Jews realized the tremendous potency of religion as a weapon to either unite their own race or a weapon to disintegrate and destroy their enemies. For thousands of years, they have capitalized upon this knowledge to the hilt. In a masterful fashion, they have manipulated religion to their advantage with a devilish cunning that no other people seems to have even suspected, least of all the white race. If we could briefly look at the wars between Rome and Carthage, and the brief siege and destruction of Jerusalem during the rise and expansion of the Roman Empire, I think we can find the answer to the Jews' survival. As Roman power increased and expanded, it was inevitable that it should soon come into conflict with the increasing power of Carthage. For over 100 years, these two great rival powers fought battles of attrition and annihilation. Finally, Rome emerged the victor, and when they had Carthage at its mercy, they leveled the city, killed all the male population, and sold the women and children into slavery. Carthage was no more. It was gone forever. Now let us contrast this with what happened to Jerusalem in the year 70 AD. During the rule of Emperor Vespasian, the Jews in Judea became rebellious. Emperor Vespasian sent General Titus down there, and after a 139-day siege of Jerusalem, the city was sacked, leveled to the ground, and the Jews were either killed or dispersed. It would seem that in a fate similar to that of Carthage, this would be the end of the Jews, but not so. The Jews had one extraordinary thing going for them, and that was a unique religion that bound their race together. Far from being destroyed, the Jews, in their cunning and resourcefulness, with their religion uniting and binding them together, planned revenge on the Romans, and revenge they did get. They inflicted on the Romans a religion that undermined the will of the Romans to survive as a race and as a nation. With tremendous zeal, the Jews propagated among the Romans a new religion with such suicidal ideas as turn the other cheek, love your enemies, resist not evil, and other such self-destructive philosophies that sapped the strength of the Romans and left them naked and defenseless before their enemies. In a few centuries, the great Roman civilization completely disintegrated and was defenseless against the marauding Vandals, who finally sacked Rome in the year 476 AD, and Rome was no more. However, with his tenacity and zeal for preserving the Jewish race as embodied in his fanatic religion, the Jew did not go down with Rome. No, on the contrary, he fed on the corpse and went from the Roman corpse to scatter and infect the incipient and growing new cultures that were emerging in Western Europe. Cultures and civilizations that were blighted from the very beginning with the handicap of the new religion with which the Jew had destroyed Rome. It is true that the Jew is tough, he is cunning, and he is treacherous. He is also tenacious, and he is persistent. All these qualities fit him well to be the foremost predator and parasite on the body of mankind. But even with all these qualities, he would not have survived had it not been for his Mosaic religion. It is the basic ingredients of his religion that bind him together in a holy brotherhood hostile to all mankind, striving, pushing, clawing, always and forever for the good of his race, for the survival of his race, and exhibiting in its raw form one of the strongest laws of nature, the propagation and survival of its own species. The Jews learned one other significant fact early in their history. There is nothing as powerful in uniting a group, any group, as having a common enemy. Based on this premise, they have seen to it that they have always been at war with other races. In fact, all other peoples are their enemies at all times. It is only a matter of strategy as to who is their prime enemy at any given time. This theory has worked wonders. It has kept the Jews united and fighting. Their solidarity has destroyed all enemies before them. It is destroying the white race today. The central theme of the Jewish religion is hatred. Hatred for the Gentiles, that is, all other races. The other overwhelmingly powerful facet of the Jewish religion is racial loyalty, loyalty to its own kind. Whereas to the average white Gentile, sadly enough, it matters very little with whom he does business, whether it is another white man or not. Nor is the average white Gentile too interested in whether the person next door or the person he meets is one of his own kind. But to the Jew, whether he is doing business with a Jew, living next door to a Jew, or meets a Jew, this means everything. Let us keep this in mind, this factor of racial loyalty, as we go about searching for a better religion for the white race. That the Judaic religion has been the rock of strength around which the Jewish race has rallied for the last 5,000 years is without question. The Jews do not believe in God, nor are they foolish enough to put their efforts or beliefs centered in a hereafter. Golda Meir, the present Prime Minister of Israel, stated succinctly when she said in her speech from the Knesset, the Israel Parliament in Yiddish, "I am a non-believer, yet no one will be able to root from the heart and mind the conviction that without the Jewish religion we would have been like all other nations who once existed and disappeared." From the earliest glimmerings of childhood, the Jewish parents inculcate into their offspring the idea of racial loyalty, the idea that the survival of the Jewish race is everything, the idea that all other races are their enemies to be either exploited or destroyed. The Jewish Old Testament is crammed full of make-believe of Jewish history, very little of it true. But interwoven through all this fantasy, the idea of racial survival is driven into their brains, advice on how to survive. It and the Talmud are full of advice and wisdom binding the Jewish race together in an indestructible unit of purpose. In Proverbs 29:18 is spelled out the idea of a long-term program. Where there is no vision, a people perish. If we contrast this with the advice the Jews foisted on the white race in the New Testament, for instance, Matthew 6:34, where it says, "Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself." Here we see clearly spelled out that it is essential for the Jews to have vision for the long term, a long-term plan. In reality, their religion is a perpetual conspiracy which is essential for their survival as a parasitic race. But in order to weaken and soften their victims for aggression, conquest, and slavery, the white race has had its brains polluted with all kinds of bad Jewish advice, of which "take no thought for tomorrow" is one of the many, and that is exactly the position of the white race today. The Jews have laid their long-term plans, going back thousands of years, for the mastery and enslavement of the world. The white race, in contrast, has no plan, no program for survival. It has no religion to rally around or to unite its white brothers. It is just fumbling, bumbling, and stumbling along with absolutely no defense against the Jew, whose historical mission it has been over thousands of years to destroy or enslave the white race. Whereas the noble white race is creative, productive, and self-sustaining, the Jews instinctively decided far back in their history that the best means of survival was to choose the role of a parasite on the bodies of other productive nations. Over the thousands of years, this decision has hardened and has become so permanently ingrained and inbred into the Jewish character that he could not now do otherwise. no more than a maggot could fend for itself without devouring the body of its host. This being so, the Jew has planned and planned and prepared. He has a far-reaching and all-encompassing program for the control, domination, and exploitation of his host, for whom he nurtures a terrible, pathological hatred. The driving force of his whole religion is hatred for his host. He has always hated his host nation with a terrible passion. How many times have we heard the expression ingrained in Jewish-controlled books about the Whore of Babylon? The fact is that the Babylonian people were a good white people, a productive people, a creative people, who were finally destroyed by the Jews in their midst. Throughout history, the Jews have propagated a vicious, lying propaganda about degeneracy of the Babylonian people. A monstrous lie. When the Jews poured into the Roman civilization and finally destroyed it with the new suicidal religion they foisted upon the Romans, they then pictured the Romans as being cruel, degenerate, and immoral. Even to this day, the Jewish movies coming out of Hollywood depict the Romans as a debauched and degenerate people. Even lying Jewish propagandists like Billy Graham perpetually denounce the Romans as cruel, debauched, and tyrannical, another terrible Jewish lie. Having chosen to play the role of a parasite far back in their history, the die is now long cast, and they can do no other than to roam the civilized world seeking any spot where they can settle down in the midst of an established community, where they can remain and prosper at the expense of others. As a parasitic people, the Jews can only survive by living on that which others produce. When they come into a community, they bring nothing with them but their cunning and their treachery. The Jew knows when he enters the Gentile community that sooner or later he will be discovered and there will be violence and retribution. The thing the Jew fears more than anything else is open detection and the ensuing physical violence. One of his phrases throughout the centuries has been, "Oy gavolt." This old Yiddish phrase translates, "O violence." Knowing that his parasitic activities of fleecing, robbing, and plundering the Gentile communities will eventually result in violence against his person, he prepares for it in advance. We go back to the quotation from Proverbs, in which the Jews are advised, "Where there is no vision, a people perish." So as he sinks his tentacles deeply into the body of the community that he is about to ravish, he prepares in advance to nullify, neutralize, and minimize the opposition from the Gentile community that he knows sooner or later will develop into hostility against him. In this respect, the Jew is very similar to other parasitic creatures of nature. When a wood tick crawls up the leg of an individual, he does so very stealthily and usually completely unnoticed. The wood tick is searching for an appropriate place on the body of the host he can dig into and suck its blood for its own nourishment. The wood tick knows that when he digs in, normally it would be painful to the host, therefore attract its attention and result in its being picked off and destroyed. But the wood tick has a remedy for this. Before digging in, he carefully anesthetizes the skin surface of the victim host. Having done this, it then carefully begins to chew and suck, all this time anesthetizing the area so that the host will feel no pain. Meanwhile, the head bores in deeper and deeper, and the parasite begins to bloat itself on the blood of its victim, without the host having felt any pain whatsoever, or even being aware of its presence. By the time the victim finally discovers the tick, it is thoroughly rooted into its flesh. The host is no longer in a position to remove it without causing pain and infection to himself and the death and destruction of the parasitic tick. Even though the victim now tries to remove the parasite, he cannot do so. He can pull off the bloated body and destroy part of the tick, but the head will remain embedded and cause infection and perhaps blood poisoning. At this stage, it becomes a major operation to remove the infectious tick, which he could have easily flicked off with a finger at the beginning, had he realized that the parasite had designs upon his blood. The parasitic operation of the Jew upon the body of his unfortunate host is very similar. Who are these strange, peculiar people who have been able to survive longer than any other race in recorded history? Who are these people that have been destroyers of such great civilizations as Rome, Babylon, and Egypt? What peculiarities in their makeup is it that has enabled them to destroy a highly wealthy country such as Russia in modern times and turn it into a Jewish slave labor camp? How, in fact, have they been able to capture the wealth of the world into their hands and turn the world into a Jewish dictatorship? How have they been able to do all this without us, the great white race of America, even being able to discuss the question intelligently without fear and trembling? It is of utmost importance that we study this creature biologically, psychologically, economically, and also from a standpoint of race and religion. Most white people are terribly confused about the Jewish race. One of the sorriest notions most Gentiles have fallen for is the mistaken idea that Jews are members of the white race. This is a most treacherous deception the Jews themselves have promoted among our people. But to their own, they have made it abundantly clear that they have nothing in common with the white race. The Jews are forever Semitics, originating out of Asia from prehistoric times. Jewish professor Leonard J. Fine makes the racial point crystal clear to his own people. We are not white symbolically, and we are not white literally. We should not permit ourselves to be lumped together with white America, for that is not where we belong. Much time is wasted among the Gentiles in arguing whether the Jews are a race, or whether they are a religion, or whether they are a nation. The fact is, they are all three, and it matters little in what proportion you want to attribute the importance of any of these three factors. From ancient times, they have constituted a race that has been the plague of the civilized world. This they have been able to do because of the uniqueness of their religion. It was primarily designed to perpetuate and preserve the race by being a parasite on the body of productive nations. They are a worldwide nation and form a nation within a nation in each country on which they have fastened their tentacles. This includes just about every country in the world. If there is one factor that has bound the Jews together and made them the most tenacious, persistent race in the world, it is their Mosaic religion and the resultant racial loyalty that has imbued upon every Jewish member. It is this racial-religious unity that makes them powerful, and it is something that we should take heed of in thinking about the preservation of the white race. The early origins of the Jewish race are lost in antiquity. The Jewish shibboleths, as set forth in the story about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are, of course, so many Jewish lies which make a good story around which they can rally their ideology, but it has absolutely no basis in fact or history. The Jews themselves have never bothered about really tracing their origins in history, which origins remain shrouded in mystery. They simply come out with a claim that they are the chosen people of God, a very special people. And they also claim the longest historical record of any people of earth. Whereas the former claim about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is a basic tenet in their religion, one that has built the Jewish race, the second claim about having the longest historical record is hard to dispute. The Jews appear and reappear in histories of other nations for 5,000 years. Being basically a predator and a parasite, they were either never able to, nor have they ever been willing to establish a nation in their own right. This is rather a sorry record for such a strange and virulent race, and incredible when one considers that they claim to be the favorite chosen of God. The word Jew is of fairly modern usage and derives from the word Judah and Judaic. In ancient history, the Jews were known as Hebrews, which derives from the Amoraic word Ebri, which in turn derives from the Hebrew word Ibri, meaning one who is from across the river. Hebrew in all ancient literature was written in Habiru, and appears as such frequently in the Bible and Egyptian literature. In the Bible, Habiru is used interchangeably with Sagez, meaning cutthroat. Thus, the Egyptians always wrote of the Jews as the cutthroat bandits from across the river. Since Palestine was the crossroads of the ancient world, most of the wealthy trade routes crossed in this area. This, of course, made it a natural habitat for bandits of cutthroats and robbers. The fact that deserts and mountains were part of the natural landscape further attributed to making this area the natural habitat for the development of a nation of bandits, cutthroats, robbers, and parasites. This is exactly what developed, and this is, as far as historical facts can show, the early origin of the Jewish race. A German Jew, Kastein, who shortened his name from Katzenstein, is recognized as an outstanding scholar of Jewish and biblical history. In his History of the Jews, Kastein identifies many of the great names in Jewish history as bandits. He mentions Jephthah as one of the saviors of the Jewish people, and identifies him as the robber chief of Gilead. Of the great Jewish hero David, he says, "At the time of Saul's death, we find David the leader of the band of freebooters, living in Ziklag. On hearing that the throne was vacant, David immediately hastened to Hebron in Judea. Nobody had summoned him, but he put forward his claim to the kingship, declaring that Samuel had secretly appointed him." About the great and wise Solomon, Kastein has this to say: "Shelmo, Solomon the peaceable, inaugurated his rule by committing 3 murders which cleared his path and got rid of his only brother, and did so without the slightest qualms of conscience." The fact that Solomon, David, and Jephthah were all bloodthirsty bandits is typical of all Jewish leaders. Whereas the Jews have been part of history since the dawn of civilization, theirs has always been a history of treachery, of bloodshed, murder, robbery, and crime. Despite the fact that this peculiar race has persisted longer than any other on the face of the earth, 2 rather strange facts stand out. One is that over these thousands of years, they never tried to form a country or nation of their own, and even today's bandit state of Israel is no exception to that statement. Israel is intended only to become the headquarters for the Jewish dictatorship of the world, not a gathering place for all the Jews of the world. The second strange fact is that this tough and persistent people has never developed a civilization or a culture of its own, all their claims to the contrary notwithstanding. One of the outstanding fortes of the Jews is the skillful manipulation of propaganda. However, the record of the Hebrews and their history shows that all the Jewish claims of culture are entirely without foundation. The Horizon Book of Christianity, a standard reference work, says the Jews began as an agglomeration of small tribes, who later attained independence only in the interlude between the rise and fall of great empires. They have bequeathed no monuments testifying to magnificence. There are no tombs of Hebrew kings with chaplets of gold and chariots studded with jewels. Palestine archaeology has unearthed no statues of David or Solomon, but only water pots like the one from which Rebecca watered the camels of Abraham's servants. The Oriental Institute of Chicago contains one of the world's most outstanding collections of the fine arts, specializing in Egyptian, Syrian, and other cultures of the Near East, in the area which the Jews claim as that of their origin. One would expect to find the Jewish contribution to civilization well represented there. After walking through vast halls filled with great works of art, splendid statues, exquisite jewels, and other artifacts from the tombs of Egyptian and Assyrian conquerors, we come to the Jewish exhibit. Here we find a glass case filled with broken bits of clay pots, crude, undecorated, and unglazed utensils which might have come down to us from the Stone Age. This is the great Jewish culture about which the Jews brag so flagrantly, and it is about all they have to offer. The fact is that the Jews were known throughout ancient history only as destroyers. They produced no art, founded no dynasties, built no great cities, and, alone of all the ancient peoples, had no talent for the finer things of culture or civilized life. Yet today, we will hear the Jews boast loud and long about how they are the sole torchbearers of civilization. The noted historian Arnold Toynbee defined the Jews for all time a few years ago, when he described them as a fossil people. By this he meant that they were a people who had failed to develop since the Stone Age, as their primitive clay pots prove to us. They were never able to master agriculture, animal husbandry, architecture, or any of the civilized arts. Even as a bandit nation, the Jews were not too successful, and eked out a precarious living in Palestine, where they were often on the verge of starvation. Castine says further of the Jews, "Some remained within the confines of Canaan. Others settled along the great military highway of the East, and in the neighboring deserts and wildernesses, where they led a nomadic existence, while a smaller section, driven by hunger, finally succeeded in reaching Egypt, where the pharaohs took them under their protection. The Egyptians, who built one of the earliest and one of the greatest civilizations of all time, failed to recognize their own great asset, the innate, inborn value of their racial lines, which produced the civilization in their midst. We have already discussed how one of their greatest mistakes was to allow the entry of the blacks from the lower Nile to come into their country and intermingle, defile, and bastardize their bloodlines. Of all the races in ancient Egypt that intermingled, the Jews alone held themselves apart. The pharaohs, having allowed the Jews to come in through sheer sympathy for their starved and miserable existence, were soon to learn the virulent and destructive nature of the parasite that they had allowed to enter. The Jews soon rose to high positions in the land of the pharaohs, and simultaneously, as was to happen in many other countries, the empires began to disintegrate. The parasites the Egyptians had taken in through sympathy, in short order, began to manifest their outstanding characteristics, namely that of tearing down a civilization from within. Gangs of bandits soon sprang up and began to harass and plunder the trade routes. They became bolder in the outposts of the empire. They seemed to know just when to strike and which of the towns were poorly guarded. With the Jews acting as leaders and catalysts, the process of trading in black slaves was increased, and the mongrelization of the white Egyptian nation was hastened. The empire began to decay from within. Its leadership became apathetic. The race became more and more tinged with black blood, and the morale of the people was undermined. Here is what Alan H. Gardner translates from an ancient papyrus in Leiden. Egypt was in distress. The social system had become disorganized. Violence filled the land. Invaders preyed upon the defenseless population. The rich were stripped of everything and slept in the open, and the poor took their possessions. It is no merely local disturbance that is here described, but a great and overwhelming national disaster. The pharaoh was strangely inactive. Here we have a typical description of the Jewish virulence in spreading disintegration and destroying a great nation upon which they had fastened their tentacles. We saw the same thing happen in the downfall of Babylon. In studying the French Revolution and the Russian Communist Revolution, we find a similar and parallel occurrence. By 2100 BC, the Egyptian nation was so demoralized and divided that they were unable to resist conquest from outside. And as usual, the Jews paved the way for the conquerors. They paved the way for the Hyksos, or shepherd kings, who won Egypt without a battle and maintained an iron dictatorship over the people for 511 years. The Hyksos were known as the protectors of the Jews. During this period of 5 centuries, the Jews were princes in Egypt, taking what they wanted from the enslaved Egyptians, and incurring their enmity by their vicious arrogance over the betrayed population. Finally, the native leaders of the Egyptians led a successful revolt and expelled the Hyksos forever. After the Egyptians regained control of their own country and their own destiny, they punished the Jews for their treachery and enslaved them for a life of hard labor. This brings us to the period of Moses, when the Jews complained about their hard lot in Egypt. Before they betrayed the nation to the Hyksos, they had enjoyed every freedom in Egypt, and it was only natural that they should now be punished for their treason. Rather than endure this slavery, they petitioned the pharaoh to let them return to Palestine and resume their life of nomadic banditry. But the outraged Egyptian people demanded that they serve out their punishment, and the pharaoh was forced to agree. Now the Jews used every device to obtain their freedom, bringing plagues upon the Egyptian people through the use of poisons and contaminating the water. They were finally allowed to depart from Egypt. It is during this period that their religion became more solidified, and the bandit race began to develop a more distinct character. From here on out, they scattered into the midst of other nations, such as the Babylonian civilization, the Greek civilization, and the Persian civilization, there to infect and infest the body of these nations and spell their destruction. A leading businessman, J.J. Kavanaugh, has compared the dispersion of the Jews to the physiological facts of cancer. He says, "The Jews can best be understood as a disease of civilization. They can be likened to the spread of cancer throughout the human system. Just as the Jews spread out through the civilized world, following the trade routes, so cancer cells spread through the body, traveling along the arteries and veins to every part of the system. And just as the Jews gather in critical areas of the world and begin to multiply and strangle and poison those communities and nations, so cancer cells gather and multiply and destroy the organs of the body, and finally, the body itself. Many historians of the ancient world noted the Jewish phenomenon and commented upon it, but most of these works have since been destroyed. When Julius Caesar arrived in Alexandria, one of the first acts that he had his soldiers perform was to burn the great libraries that the Egyptians had accumulated in Alexandria. Since Julius Caesar was a defender of the Jews and one of their agents, this is easily understood. If we still had these libraries, these books, and this information available to us today, we would undoubtedly be able to focus a lot more light on the influence of Jewish infestation on the ancient civilizations. Among the few comments on Jews which have survived the Jewish destruction of libraries are those of Philo and Strabo. Philo, an important historian, wrote that Jewish communities had spread out all over the continents and islands. Strabo's comments upon the Jews, written in the time of the Emperor Augustus of Rome, is even more revealing. He wrote, "This people, the Jews, has already made its way into every city, and it is not easy to find any place in the habitable world which has not received this nation, and in which it has not made its power felt." So we see that as the Roman civilization developed, the Jews were there. By the time of Julius Caesar, the Jews were a powerful and controlling influence on the financial structure of Rome and the government of Rome itself. Julius Caesar was one of their agents, as in modern times were Roosevelt and Churchill. By this time, the Romans themselves were becoming well aware of the evil and destructive influence that the Jews heaped upon their nation, and there began a reaction against the Jews. The Romans, like so many other peoples who were infested with this parasite, made attempt after attempt to get the Jews out of Rome, but they always came back. Rome, at the time of Julius Caesar, was operating under a republican, democratic form of government made up of many opposing political parties and groups, a situation similar to what we find in America today. In order to win, a politician needed the support of one group which would stick by him without fail, and thus influence other groups to support him. In Roman times, as in the present-day democracies, the one solidified, united group who knew their purpose in politics were the Jews. They would guarantee their support to any politician who, in turn, would become their stooge. Julius Caesar discovered this simple fact of life. He sought out the Jews and won their support. With the Jews behind him, Caesar soon became the dictator of Rome and the unchallenged ruler of the world. Alarmed by his increasing subservience to the Jews, a group of loyal senators led by Brutus, a former friend of Caesar's in his pre-Jewish period, resolved to assassinate him. We have all heard of the famous assassination of Julius Caesar, but few have heard of the central fact in the case, namely that Julius Caesar was assassinated because he was a stooge for the Jews. Emperor Augustus, who inherited the empire after Caesar's generals fell out amongst themselves, again restored special privileges to the Jews. This explains why he emerged stronger than the other factions which divided Rome after Caesar's death. Despite this strong Jewish influence, one factor emerged that helped strengthen the Roman position. The democratic republican form of government changed to the empire form, with an emperor as head of the nation. The Romans had finally found from experience that the multi-party system, with the powers split among several divisive factions, was a weak and ineffective method of government. When they changed over to the leadership principle, the empire for 200 years progressed amidst peace and prosperity. In fact, Pax Romana, a period from the time of Emperor Augustus to approximately 200 AD, was the longest period of peace in the history of civilized nations of the world and in the history of the white race. We must remember that this was accomplished despite the Jewish influence and because some of the emperors had the intestinal fortitude to resist the Jewish power. This they could never have done under the democratic republican system of government. We find, therefore, under Emperor Vespasian, that when the Jews in Jerusalem and Judea rebelled, he sent General Titus down there to lay siege to the city. In short order, the city was conquered. The inhabitants were either slain or sold into captivity, and the city itself was leveled to the ground. Roman justice was tough and final, but the Jews were far from finished. It was at this time that Jewish hatred for the Romans reached its peak intensity. They hated the Romans with a vengeance as they had the Babylonians, whom they had destroyed earlier. This is a key characteristic of the Jews, to hate with a fierce passion the hosts upon whom they are feeding and whom they have marked for destruction. The fact that the host has been their main means of sustenance makes no difference. Like a true parasite, they will pursue the destruction of their host to the bitter end, although this might mean their own destruction. Having learned the lesson in the destruction of Jerusalem, that they were no match for the Romans in open combat, the treacherous and cunning mind of the Jews conceived a means of pulling down and destroying the Roman Empire. It was during this period, shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem, that the Jews feverishly began propagating the Christian ideology, which implanted in the minds of the Romans such suicidal ideas as turn the other cheek, love thine enemy, sell all thou hast and give it to the poor. Resist not evil, judge not, think not of the morrow, lay up treasures in heaven. The new religion that the Jews foisted upon the Romans promised them that if they would do all these suicidal things, they would get their reward in the hereafter, eternal salvation, etc. The Romans fell for this suicidal advice with the bait of a promised reward in the hereafter. Shortly thereupon, the Roman Empire went into rapid decline. When the Roman Empire collapsed, one of the primary reasons for its fall was the declining birth rate of the white Roman children. History records that eventually there was virtually no one left to rule Rome, but mongrelized minority groups who had bred themselves into the majority and formed the mindless mob that brought death and destruction to the Roman Empire. Today the same thing is happening in America as young people of white racial ancestry are being taught and bombarded with the idea that it is a sin to bring children into the world, and that if they wish to have children, they should adopt some poor underprivileged children of a minority race, meaning niggers. After the death of Emperor Domitian in 96 AD, the emperors of Rome were no longer of Roman birth. From there on, they were all foreigners influenced by Jewish advisers in the background. By the year 313 AD, Emperor Constantine, in the Edict of Milan, proclaimed Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. From there on out, under the influence of the Jewish ideology imposed on the Roman people, history shows that Rome began to disintegrate rapidly. By the year 476 AD, the barbarians from the west had conquered Rome with hardly any opposition. The will of the now mongrelized and Christianized people of Rome to defend their nation and homes was gone. Rome was no more. In all other history books, and especially in religious circles, we are told that Christianity and the Jews were in opposition. that Christ denounced the Jews, that the Jews crucified Christ. Even today, we are being told in kosher conservative circles that the main objective of the Jews is to destroy Christianity. This is, of course, one of the biggest hoaxes in the history of the world. The facts are plainly there for everyone to see. The Jews concocted Christianity as their special poison to unhinge the minds of the Romans, so that they would no longer be able to maintain their civilization. This was the Jews' revenge for the destruction of Jerusalem and the biological manifestation of the intense Jewish hatred for the host nation upon which they prey. The Jewish historian Castine frankly admits this extraordinary characteristic of the Jews. He says, "To the Jews, Rome constituted the quintessence of all that was odious and should be swept away from off the face of the earth. They hated Rome and her device, arma et leges, with an inhuman hatred." We have seen other examples of how the Jew continues to hate the people he has destroyed. Centuries after Babylon was no more, the Jew fulminates again and again about the whore of Babylon. But of all nations, the Jews hated Rome the most, probably because Rome represented one of the finest examples of what a beautiful and powerful civilization the creative and productive white race can produce. So terrible is the hatred that the parasitic Jew has for the host upon whom he feeds, that it is most important for the Jew to mask his true feelings. Consequently, he always appears bearing an olive branch. His first word is shalom, or peace. It is this necessity to conceal his true feelings which leads the Jew to conduct his affairs and his meetings in secret. We, the white people of the globe, have much to learn from the history of Rome. Roman history probably is the greatest teacher mankind will ever have, for all time. They built a wonderful civilization, an achievement that has never been equaled. On the negative side, the lessons we can learn are even stronger. Let us examine what these lessons are. First, on the positive side. 1. The civilization the Romans created was a result of what the Romans themselves were. A blonde, tall, blue-eyed white race, endowed by nature with beauty, creativity, and intelligence. 2. They were, during their rise and development, a pure and unadulterated race. Their rise continued as long as they remained a pure race. It halted, declined, and decayed as they became mongrelized through the mixture of races injected into their national bloodstream. 3. They were manly, brave, courageous, and outstanding warriors. In a few centuries they had conquered most of the then known world. 4. They were systematic, well organized, and had a penchant for law, order, and organization. They were the greatest lawgivers that the world has ever seen. Most of the laws of the civilized Western world is based originally on Roman law. 5. They developed the most expressive and orderly language in the history of mankind. Today, 2,000 years later, the Latin language has still not been equaled. 6. They had an inborn sense of responsibility towards their homes, their family, and their country. 7. They were a creative, culture-loving people and developed language, literature, art and sculpture to the heights never before attained and, perhaps, in some respects, not equal today. 8. They could be hard and decisive when dealing with their enemies, as, for example, the complete destruction of Carthage and Jerusalem. On the negative side, we can learn the following. 1. The Romans failed to realize that their empire, their civilization and their greatness were due to the inherent quality of their outstanding racial stock. 2. They imported blacks and other inferior peoples into their empire, and took no decisive measures to prevent the contamination of their precious bloodlines. 3. The Romans had a useless and pointless religion that was a copy of and a modification of the Greek mythologies and their gods. The essence of their religion consisted of a number of gods and semi-gods, cavorting and clowning from one mischievous affair to another. It did absolutely nothing to give the Romans purpose or unity. It contributed nothing towards any racial or national goals, nor did it teach them the value of their marvelous race. In summation, it failed to protect them from racial destruction. 4. They were completely unable to cope with the treacherous and cunning Jew in their midst. Because they allowed the mongrelization of their racial stock, the infiltration of the Jew into their finances, education, and government, and because they succumbed to the suicidal new Christian religion, they perished miserably. 5. If they had a strong sense of racial loyalty rather than national loyalty to Rome and embodied this as their national religion, they would neither have been mongrelized nor would they have succumbed to the poisonous new religion the Jew injected into their thinking, a religion which unhinged their reasoning and brought about their destruction. 6. Had the Romans had such a religion instead of the silly, superficial religion they copied from the Greeks, Roman civilization would undoubtedly have survived to this day, and for many thousands of years thereafter. In fact, civilizations do not die except when their racial blood becomes contaminated, and the progeny is no longer the same as the forefathers who created the original civilization and culture. 7. If Roman civilization had prevailed, what a blessing for the world it would have been. Instead of a Jew-ridden world racked by revolution, dissension, and anarchy, teeming with increasing floods of mongrels and coloreds, we would today have a beautiful white world in every part of every continent, prosperous, peaceful, orderly, and productive. We would have a world minus the colored and inferior scum that infests so much of the good real estate of the globe today, and undoubtedly minus that destroyer of all civilizations, the parasitic Jew.